Welcome to the New Thinking for a New World podcast, where we explore the most pressing issues that are challenging and changing our societies. We are looking for new thinking and new solutions wherever we can find them. Listen as host Alan Stoga, the Thalberg Foundation's chairman, challenges his guests for analysis, ideas, and actions. Together, we can help make our world at least a bit better.
Sudan is at war with itself. Since the 2019 uprising that booted Omar al-Bashir from office after 30 years, the country has experienced coups and lots of fighting. Today, two generals are locked in mortal combat for power and wealth. On the one hand, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan of the Sudanese army, and on the other, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo of the Rapid Support Forces. Of course, the Sudanese people pay an enormous price for their rivalry, with millions displaced, a crushed economy, and spreading hunger and disease. The tragedy of Sudan is compounded by the risk of broader conflict in the Horn of Africa, which abounds with deep-seated conflicts and tensions. A regional war stoked by outside powers would make Sudan's plight dramatically worse. My guest today is well positioned to help us understand this witch's brew and where it might be heading. Sama Salman is a Sudanese businesswoman and civil society leader. At the moment, she is in Washington, D.C., trying to help her country find peace. Welcome, Sama.
Thank you so much, Alan, and thank you for this platform.
Let's start with the lead protagonists, Generals Burhan and Dagalo, who goes by the nickname of Hemedy. Both leaders of the junta that has recently ruled, if not governed, your country. What do they want?
You know, Alan, that is a very good question. What they both want is power and wealth. And they have both built huge political and economic empires. And at this stage in time, it looks like it's a winner-take-all battle. And they've taken the 47 million citizens of Sudan hostage.
General Burhan has been a dominant player in post-Bashir Sudan. He signed a power-sharing agreement in 2019 and then another agreement in 2022, both of which promised a democratic transition. Do you think he believes, maybe ever believed, in a democratic future for your country?
Well, Alan, let's unravel that a little bit. That's a big question. I think it makes sense to understand who General Burhan is, how he came to be, as well as General Hemedti. General Burhan is actually a remnant of General Omar al-Bashir's old guard. He was part of General al-Bashir's government and army. As everyone knows, Omar al-Bashir ruled Sudan with an iron fist for 30 years, and he was finally ousted by the revolution in 2019. So General Burhan is actually a recreation of Omar al-Bashir's administration. And the same thing goes for General Hemedti. So to say that either one of them, both of them being creations of Omar al-Bashir, could actually want democracy, I think is very far-fetched.
Hemedti seems like a particularly unusual person. He comes out of the Janjaweed militia, which we all know from the Darfur conflict. It is alleged he has strong Russia connections. His RSF controls the gold mines, which must mean they have a relationship with the Wagner Group, the Russian private militia army. Yet he's been trying to position his militia, the RSF, as an agent of democratic change, which sounds absurd to my ears. Am I missing something?
It is pretty absurd. And it's absurd to us Sudanese as well. And let me try to tell you a little bit about what's going on, because it can be confusing for those who aren't acquainted with Sudanese politics. It's actually confusing for Sudanese who are deep in the middle of Sudanese politics. So if we take a step back, let me paint a picture of what's actually going on in Sudan. Currently, there are two armies in Sudan. There is no country in the world that has two armies. Each will, in this case, the fact that we have two armies means that each will assert their dominance and will be rivals trying to crush the other. the way we came into having two armies is rather bizarre. General Omar al-Bashir, who ruled Sudan from 1989 through a military coup of his own until he was ousted in 2019 by the Sudan Revolution, actually hired Hemeti, who was at that time a camel trader. He hired Hemeti in 2003 when the Darfur Civil War was ignited, and he hired him to fight the rebel elements that were coming out of Darfur. Hemeti's forces continued to grow during the Darfur War. He reached about 30 to 40,000 men. And that's when Hemeti's paramilitary force started to take shape and become very visible. So that is how Hemeti came to create his army. So Bashir actually gave Hemeti independence. He felt that Hemeti has had his own mandate to fight the war in Darfur. He was doing it better than the job that the Sudanese armed forces were doing. And he felt that he wanted to have a direct line of communication with Hemeti. And this is how the RSF is born.
So fast forward to 2023. You have two armies in the country. They had been allied for a while. That alliance is obviously now broken down. And interestingly, people aren't calling it a civil war. I don't quite understand why, but it certainly looks like a civil war from a distance.
Okay, so how the war was actually sparked. Let's go to the December 2022 framework agreement. There was an agreement in December 2022 that was put in place with the help of the African Union, the United Nations, and the entire international community, with along with a host of mechanisms, that basically was trying to negotiate a way out of the military coup that Generals Burhan and Hemeti both carried out together in October 2021, which ousted the transitional democratic government that they were a part of. So basically, in October 2021, Burhan and Hemeti got together and said, enough of this whole transitional democratic government business and enough of the Sudanese revolution. Sudanese revolution, of course, started in December 2018.
Sama, let me interrupt, because you've used the word democratic, and I think you mean civilian, right? In the sense that the government that they were part of was not an elected government, I don't think. It was rather an appointed government, but it was supposed to be a transitory government.
The reason it's called a transitional democratic government is because the ultimate objective was to transition to democracy. So the mandate of that transitional government was to say, okay, we've got this period of 4 years after 30 years of dictatorial rule, where we are going to start to build the governance and institutional foundations that will allow us to hold elections and move to democracy. So the mandate was to move to democracy, basically. You have 30 years of dictatorial rule that ended in April 2019, with the revolution, the People's Revolution, which I took a part of in Khartoum. So you had protests day and night where people relentlessly camped outside of the government buildings, as well as camped outside of the army headquarters, and basically saying that enough was enough. And we had enough of Bashir's rule. Sudanese people, we had just suffered for way too long. So basically what happened is that there was one fateful night in April 2019, when the pressure had built up on al-Bashir and his government so much that it was estimated that about 100,000 people were now camped outside of the army headquarters. So the final nail in the coffin of Bashir's rule is when Hemeti changed the palace guards one night and in the morning arrested al-Bashir. So ultimately, what you had was a revolution that ended with a palace coup. So Hemeti and Burhan came in and actually took advantage opportunistically of this revolution to say, okay, Bashir is so weak and the people have all risen up against him. This is our opportunity to come in and take power. So what happens after that is the negotiations that precede the formation of a government were actually to negotiate a power-sharing agreement between, on one side, the military, Burhan and Hemeti, and on the other side, the civilians, to see how they could come together, these two parties, to share power. And it was that negotiated agreement that led to the democratic transitional government.
Let me interrupt, because you used the word democratic, but we agree it was democratic in aspiration, not in fact.
Well, okay, so the term democratic is problematic, and you're actually pushing me on this, Alan, and I appreciate that, because I think we've used the term democratic because the way we came to that government was through a people's revolution demanding democracy. And when a constitutional agreement was signed, it was signed with the objective to form a democratic government. So the ultimate aim and outcome of the transitional government, the power-sharing agreement, was to say, okay, these two sides are going to share power for 4 years, but during this period, we're going to build the institutions and the capabilities and bring the capacity in that will allow us to hold democratic elections so that then we could transition fully to a democratic government. So actually, I mean, if we start to pull this apart, you're right. It's a government built on a power-sharing agreement between the military and civilians.
But that power-sharing agreement is finished, de facto.
Well, you know, that's if we assume that the power-sharing agreement was ever genuine to start with. And I was one of those people who said, these generals are not coming to the negotiating table in good faith. And I continue to say that even to the U.S. State Department in December 2022, when the framework agreement was signed, I said, these generals are not coming to the table in good faith. We have a history in Sudan of 67 years of independence. 54 out of those 67 years have been ruled by dictators and autocrats. So we've only had 13 years of civilian slash democratic rule. So 80% of Sudan's history has been ruled by dictators. So we certainly don't have a good track record of dictators handing over power to civilian government and being happy with that.
A world under stress needs leaders in every discipline and in every country. Leaders whose work is innovative, courageous, rooted in universal values and global in approach or implication. If you know someone like that, in your company, in your university, in your community, anywhere, please nominate that person for the Thalberg SNF Aliassin Global Leadership Prize. Go to thalbergprize.org. That's Thalberg prize.org.
So we are where we are. We have two armies in the field fighting each other. We have Khartoum in the process, perhaps, of being destroyed. Hundreds of thousands of new refugees, both internally and externally. And an international community, which arguably, with the best of intentions, failed in their effort to create a peaceful framework within which, as you said, there could be a transition towards democracy.
The framework agreement that was signed in late 2022 had a clause in it that said that Hemeti's paramilitary government would need to be integrated into the Sudanese armed forces. And that made Hemeti very angry, because at 150,000 troops strong, he believes that he is just as powerful and just as legitimate as the Sudanese armed forces, the regular army of the state. And that's where we find ourselves. We find ourselves in a personal disagreement between two men as to who heads the country's legitimate army. And that is the situation that has brought us to where we are today. But there's a third hidden layer in this, war. And it's important to point who that is. And that is the Islamists of Omar al-Bashir's former regime. They didn't go away quietly. When Omar al-Bashir was jailed, of course, Omar al-Bashir has been wanted by the ICC for a very long time now. They pledged to come back into power. They said that this would not be the last of us. So even though some of the key Omar al-Bashir regime figures were arrested, none of them were fully persecuted. They weren't held accountable. So they sat underground with their hidden within their hidden cells and their militias. And the reports are that it's actually the cells, the militia cells of Omar al-Bashir, who have sided with the Sudanese armed forces, who actually fired the first shots on April 15th against the RSF of Hemeti and ignited this war.
There's an argument out there that the foreign powers, the US, the UK, the Saudis, and the Emiratis, either did too little. The British former parliamentarian Rory Stewart's argument, or tried to do too much too fast. As you've just said, 80% of the country's history has not been democratic. The institutions don't exist. The experiences of democracy aren't there. What happens next?
What happens next is dependent on so many different variables, both internal and external. And your question is a really important one because we have actors within Sudan who influences what happens next. We have regional actors who are currently influencing what happens next. And we have international, global actors who are trying to influence what happens next. There are so many hands in this pot, stirring in it, that it's a very fluid situation and it's very difficult to determine what's going to happen next. We have several scenarios that could unfold, none of them being very good. But one thing that I think is important to go back to is you had mentioned the Russians earlier, and you had said that the Wagner Group is supporting Hemeti and supplying him with arms and military training, and that's very true. Hemeti has had an agreement with several years now to supply the Wagner Group with gold from Sudan's mines in the west in Darfur. And that flow of financial funds through to Russia has actually been exposed to be partially financing the war in Ukraine. So there are a lot of hidden elements around the war in Sudan and the players in Sudan that also influence what's happening outside of Sudan. Russia is also, funny enough, supporting Burhan. So because Burhan and Hemeti were actually allies until recently, Russia had cut a deal with Al-Burhan for a naval base, a military naval base in the Red Sea. So Putin is dealing directly with Al-Burhan, and Prigozhin's Wagner Group is dealing directly with Hemeti. That's how complicated the situation is.
I mentioned before the Quad, the US, UK, Saudi, and the UAE, who were instrumental in trying to put this, both to put together the arrangement, but keep it together. It's failed. Obviously, it's failed. The war is testimony to that. Do you expect those four countries to try again? Are they able to construct something, do you think?
What's happening now is there are negotiations in Saudi Arabia that are being headed by the United States and Saudi Arabia jointly to try to bring a cessation of hostilities and a ceasefire, as well as a permanent peace agreement and solution to this war. They're working very hard. At the moment, each of the generals think that they can win. They're locked in a fight in which the balance of power is very close. And they have destroyed so much of Sudan and Khartoum that at this stage, they're willing to destroy each other. Actually, Hemeti, in one of his media interviews, was calling for Burhan's head, while Burhan was saying that he wouldn't be deterred by any sort of sanctions against Sudan or against himself, and that he would do what he had to do for the sanctity of Sudan's independence and to crush this rebellion of Hemeti. So you can see these two men both using incredibly inflamed rhetoric around this conflict. That's why it looks like neither one of them is going to rest until one of them either captures or kills the other, unfortunately. Now, the international community is coming together. They don't want to see a destabilized Horn of Africa. It's not in the interest of a lot of our regional countries and neighboring countries and allies to see this war continue either. So as much as they work to bring a cessation to the hostilities to the table, we've had 7 ceasefire agreements that have been violated since April 15th.
So I'm going to push back. I don't see any evidence of the international community working effectively. Sure, there's diplomats talking, they're working hard if diplomats can work hard. But as you've just pointed out, so far and counting, 7 ceasefires have come and gone. The interests of the two parties are to keep on fighting. Is there any reason to believe that whether it's the Saudis or the Americans or the Brits or whomever would bring real pressure? And if so, what kind of pressure would actually make these two stop fighting?
There is pressure that could help bring stop this fighting, and that would be real seriousness about the UN arms embargo and real seriousness about a no-fly zone. Those are both measures that would need to be brought forward by the UN Security Council. You have a situation where China and Russia have been vetoing anything related to UN sanctions on Sudan in the past few years. So you have a real reluctance by those two countries to bring any measures to actually clamp down on Burhan and Hemeti. That's one of the troubling aspects of the situation at the UN right now.
But further, a no-fly zone requires somebody to enforce it. That requires both troops and air power. We've seen in the case of Ukraine a complete unwillingness to impose a no-fly zone. Why is this different? Why would the Americans or the Brits, I'm not sure who else might do it, be willing to put their forces in harm's way?
One of the reasons is that there's an enormous amount of economic interdependence between Sudan and its neighbors. If there are neighbors that have interests in a stable Sudan, they would be those in the Gulf, like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which import tremendous amounts of gold from Sudan. They also rely highly on agricultural exports from Sudan for food security. The same goes for Egypt in the north. There's a lot of livestock and a lot of food that gets exported out of Sudan to Egypt. The same thing goes for Chad and South Sudan. In fact, Sudan is in such bad shape right now because they're at risk of the oil that flows out of South Sudan through Sudan being cut off. And that's because most of the imports, the inputs into the oil production process come in through Port Sudan, and the oil flows out of Sudan. So you have an entire region that could be destabilized and be cut off from very important food and resource flows if this war continues.
But can you imagine those countries or the Western countries actually imposing a solution through military force?
I think that the international community has become overwhelmed by the number of conflicts across the globe. I think resources have become stretched thin. I think the U.S. has seen some of its failures in wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the amount of money and troops that were mobilized and lives lost. And so I don't think that the international community currently has the appetite to actually intervene militarily in Sudan, no. But what we do see happening, and it's quite dangerous, is that there is a heavy flow of arms that's coming in through Libya, through Haftar and his army, through Chad. There are reports that there are arms coming in from Egypt. We know that the Russians are sending arms to Sudan. So we have a conflict that, if not stymied, if this flow of arms isn't stymied in one way or another, could protract. And you could see the surplus of arms going to countries like South Sudan. And you have those militias in South Sudan who are looking to destabilize Salva Kiir's rule in South Sudan. You have the same situation in Chad at the moment. And I think that if the conflict in Sudan reaches a point where these militia cells in other surrounding countries start to become activated, you might start to see wars reemerge in the entire region.
Oh, it is a scary scenario. There's absolutely no doubt. Go to the future. You want a democratic Sudan, and you've been willing to work for one. But can you imagine a path, however far in the future, that could lead to a real democracy in your country?
I believe that the revolution in 2019, which ousted 30 years of dictator Omar al-Bashir's rule, is the same revolution that is being ignited currently by the youth. And I believe that that desire that was so strong in 2019 is still alive today. The sacrifices that have been made, the thousands who have been killed in the protests and have been killed after the protests and are now being killed in the war, the Sudanese war currently raging through Sudan, I don't think that these are small marks in Sudan's history. I think what you see happening is a trajectory where all of this energy is moving towards an inevitable outcome, which is the fact that the up-and-coming generations no longer accept dictatorial rule in Sudan. And I am one of those who say that we will no longer be ruled by the military in Sudan. And so I see a point in time where we emerge from this war stronger and we say, okay, tremendous damage and losses have accrued. How are we going to use that as an opportunity to rebuild Sudan and create a new Sudan for ourselves?
Sama, I wish you and those who think like you the best, because we need that outcome. We need that outcome not just for Sudan, but for the region, the Horn of Africa, which is, as you said, important. And Sudan ought to be a leader of that region, but it can only get there if it does evolve eventually into a true democracy. So thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you, Alan. And I appreciate you giving time to exploring what is going on with Sudan. I mean, I know it can be a complicated situation. So I appreciate the platform, this platform where you've given us the time to work through the issues around Sudan. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. Please rate our show on Apple Podcast and subscribe. Meanwhile, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Or you can subscribe to our newsletter at talbergfoundation.org to learn more about our work. That's talbergfoundation.org. Thank you, and we'll be back again next week for another episode of Talberg's New Thinking for a New World. This podcast was brought to you through the generous support of SNF, the Stavros Niarchos Foundation.